Welcome to the South Cars Outreach Program. Join our training session in progress.
This is KD0CDQ. Welcome to the Outreach Program, sponsored by the South Coast Amateur Radio Service. This program has been established to help those wishing to learn more about our hobby and to further assist those wishing to upgrade license status. This will be an in-depth course pertaining to what one should know when studying for an extra class license. This course will be conducted with two sessions weekly, which will be at 7 p.m. Eastern, 2300 Zulu, each Tuesday and Sunday evening. For those that are already licensed and wish either a refresher course or would just like to listen, please connect to our SCARS, that's S-C-A-R-S, server, at either EchoLink node number 96140 or IRLP node 9614, letting it drop. For those that are interested, please contact myself, Mike, Kilo Delta Zero, Charlie Delta Quebec, via email at voip@voipnet.southcars.com to enroll in the class and be given directions as to the study material required and the manner to which you will be connected into the course. The material being presented is formatted from data obtained from the ARRL and is simply being followed in a presentation format by SCARS. Should anyone take issue to some of the technical statements made, and in keeping with not interrupting the class and session, please convey your comments or suggestions to the outreach program at voip@voipnet.southcars.com. Letting a drop. It should be mentioned this course covers only the requirements pertaining to the United States Part 97 rules and does not include other requirements that may be found in foreign countries. Should any other country other than the United States wish to have their own licensing sessions on this server, please drop us an email at voip@voipnet.southcars.com. The session this evening will be recorded and posted on our website. It'll be posted at www.voip.southcars.com. Please note, for all of our class members and instructors, it's extremely important that we stay on the same page during these classes. The only question pool and copy thereof that should be used when participating in this class should be the one found posted on our website. Publications from other sources may or may not be current and should not be used during our sessions. Letting it drop. Do we have any emergency or out of the ordinary business that must be handled before we start this evening's program? Over. Okay, in the text box, I will list the question numbers as we go through. So in case you don't hear quite correctly, get a look in the box. If I make a mistake, I will correct it. So I believe this evening, tonight we have two good instructors. We have Roger, W4RFJ, and George, N070. So we're going to start tonight with Roger. I believe Roger has the first question. If not, we'll see what goes. Here we go. Off we go. KD0CDQ.
Okay, I'm under the impression, Mike, that you passed it to me, but I think George is supposed to fess up to something before it comes to me. Over.
Gee whiz, I hope he was going to get away with it. Okay, George, you can fess up to that one question that you had that was a little complex in the answer. That's Echo 5 Bravo 12, I believe. Go ahead, George. Over.
KD0CDQ in the net, N070. Well, thank you, Chief, and thank you, Mike. All right. And good evening to everyone in the net and the class. Again, welcome and congratulations on your interest in your hobby of ham radio and increasing your skill level. And speaking of skill levels, when I went back to listen to the recording of Sunday night's presentation or lesson, I heard myself saying the opposite of what my brain was saying regarding the answer to Echo 5 B12, the calculation method involved with it. So I'd like to ask the class's patience as I correct my description of the calculation that resulted in the answer to that question, Echo 5 Bravo 12. The question was, what is admittance? And the answer is, it is the inverse of impedance. And I went on to describe the calculation of that. You find admittance by taking the mathematical inverse of impedance. So what you want to do for that calculation, as an example, the admittance of 50 ohms of impedance is going to be 1 divided by the 50 ohms of impedance. I said admittance in the class Sunday night by mistake. My apologies. So the admittance of 50 ohms of impedance is 1 divided by 50, or 0.02. The second example was the admittance of 2 ohms of impedance is 1 divided by 2, or 0.5. So you want to divide the ohms of impedance into 1 to get the inverse of impedance, which will give you the admittance. So I just switched the words of impedance and admittance at the end of the lesson last Sunday night. So my apologies to you, but I wanted to make sure to fess up and correct that, because I would not have been happy with myself had I allowed you to proceed with the information as it was Sunday evening. So are there any questions on this? You're not going to embarrass me or anything. I want to make sure everyone understands that it's the inverse of impedance. Are there any questions on Echo 5 Bravo 12 or the calculation method? Please do call 8070. Over. Nothing heard. Well, Chief, I want to turn it to you and take another sip of coffee and try to do better tonight. How are you doing tonight, Chief? And thanks. Good to hear your voice, too. W4RFJ for getting us started on the Tuesday night questions. This is N070. Over.
Well, thank you, George. This is W4RFJ, and I have the honor of presenting question number Echo 5 Charlie 03. Now, there is a question right after it, Echo 5 Charlie 04, which falls along the same line, so I'm including both questions in this one response. I think the best way to look at these two questions, let me read them first. Echo 5 Charlie 03, which of the following represents an inductive reactance in polar coordinates? And question Echo 5 Charlie 04, which of the following represents a capacitive reactance in polar coordinates? Okay, the answer for the inductive reactance is a positive phase angle, and the answer for the capacitive reactance is a negative phase angle. And you're probably wondering, okay, you get reactance, but how does that make it negative? Well, I think it has a lot to do with the formulas. If you look at the formula for inductance, to find the reactance is 2 pi FL. Let me reset the timer. Okay, 2 pi, pi being 3.14159, 2 times that times the frequency in hertz times the inductance in Henry's. Now, this is considered a positive number. You know, you're working with regular variables, so you're going to get a positive number. The reason why they say capacitive reactance is going negative is because of the way they represent it in the graphs. And if you look at the formula, it's 1 all over 2 pi FC. Well, 2 pi F is the same as it is in the inductor, except you're plugging in a capacitor. And to find a capacitive reactance, you have to take the inverse of it. So the inverse being the opposite, it gets labeled a negative. Let me reset. All right, give me just a second here. My computer is freezing up on me. Okay, so moving ahead, if you graph... If you graph the inductance or the reactance and the resistance, of course your inductive reactance is a plus J, so it would go up, and your line between your resistance and your reactance would be your impedance. And if you look at the angle, it's a positive going angle. Of course, if you had an overall capacitive reactance, your angle would go to the negative side. So I do have a of some pictures in a document that I have, and I'm hoping I can figure out a way for us to share that. Does anybody have any questions on what I've just explained? Inductive reactance has a positive angle. Capacitive reactance has a negative angle. This is W4RFJ. Wow, I'm patting myself on the back for that one. George, I guess nobody has a question. It's your turn, sir. W4RFJ.
W4RFJ in the net, NO70. Well, thank you, Chief. Our next question up is Echo 5, Charlie 06, E5-06. The question is, what does the impedance value of 50 minus J25 represent? And the answer is going to be B, 50 ohms resistance, that's the 50 you see, in series with 25 ohms of capacitive reactance. This is actually fairly easy to look at. You don't even really need to do any calculations for this. The number 50 represents the resistive component. That eliminates answers C and D, because it's going to be 50 ohms of resistance. That leaves you with the question of, is it inductive reactance or capacitive reactance? Now, if you just happen to look back at question Echo 5, Charlie 01, it says that X here would indicate capacitive reactance. So we have a minus J25, not plus. It says 50 minus J25. The minus is capacitive reactance. So the answer is 50 ohms of resistance. The minus J25 represents 25 ohms of capacitive reactance. Therefore, the answer would be B. And once again, we want you to look at the text of the answers and not memorize the alpha designators. They will change as Gordon has been kind enough to remind us. So the answer is 50 ohms resistance in series with 25 ohms of capacitive reactance. Are there any questions on Echo 5, Charlie 06? Please call NO70. Over. Nothing heard. Okay, Chief, back to you. W4RFJ, NO70. Over.
Okay, Gordon. I mean, George, sorry. I was thinking Gordon. Yes, and it seems like these questions are really jumping back and forth to the same information. Inductors are positive. Capacitance is negative. So if you see a positive J, that's inductive. Negative J, that's capacitive. And that takes us right into the questions Echo 5, Charlie 09, and question Echo 5, Charlie 10. Now, Echo 5, Charlie 09 asks, when using a rectangular coordinate to graph the impedance of a circuit, what does the horizontal axis represent? It represents resistance. Okay? Echo 5, Charlie 10, when using a rectangular coordinates for graphing the impedance of a circuit, what does the vertical axis represent? And, of course, that is the reactive component. So there you have it. With the rectangular coordinates, vertical is reactance, horizontal is resistance. Any questions, comments, and changes and or deletions, please call W4RFJ. Okay, hearing none. Sorry if I paused too long there. George, it's over to you, W4RFJ.
W4RFJ, NO70. Thank you, Chief. My next question here is Echo 5, Charlie 08. Echo 5, Charlie 08. What coordinate system is often used to display the phase angle of a circuit containing resistance, inductive, and or capacitive reactance? And the answer is going to be polar coordinates, D. As Chief just talked about, the vertical and horizontal axis of the vertical being the reactance and the horizontal being the resistance. Now, I got to thinking about such a short answer and how to help the answer of just polar coordinates make sense. And I think I came up with something. You know, we've been talking about all these calculations here, and maybe in terms of resonance and these different coordinates and trigonometry, I came up with an idea that I'd like to present to you. Let me reset the link. We're talking about polar coordinates, we're talking about the graphs, the angles, and so forth. So let me use an analogy here. If you can teach something to your grandmother, you can probably teach it. So I'm going to try to explain this to my help my grandmother out, and maybe you'll find it interesting. Let's think about some people playing tug of war, where the rope is running east to west or on the x-axis. Now you're going to pull in two other people, one that is on the side of the rope toward the North Pole and the one on the side of the rope toward the South Pole. They're going to be pulling on the rope that is involved in a tug of war. So as they pull on the rope that's going straight across, it's going to pull the rope either toward the North Pole or toward the South Pole, depending upon which of those is stronger. And that would be the inductance or capacitive components or people pulling. Well, guess what? Whoever has more of the reactants, then the rope is going to move that way. As you see the rope move up or down on this round circle of polar coordinates, then you have obviously a movement in a circle, and therefore the coordinate system of polar coordinates can be used to display the phase angle of a circuit based upon the amount of pull, either way, one or the other. So I'll have to ask my grandma how I did about explaining that. My question now to the class is, how did I do explaining it to you? I hope you have some questions about polar coordinates and what we've been discussing. Please call 070 with any questions. Over.
6, Victor.
Thank goodness. Thank you, and thank you for coming aboard, Gordon. KY6V, 070. Over.
I just wanted to say, George, thank you. I like that analogy. Put a little humor in there, though. I need to ask you a question. This tug-of-war and pulling on the rope, if one side sags a little bit, does that change the angle? Over.
KY6V in the group, NO70. Well, if the rope sags, you know, that's a doggone good question. I think you said that was humorous, but actually, if you start to apply quantum mechanics to it, it does change the answer, but that may be beyond scope. All right, now back to the, and that was a serious, but you know, we're talking about the values. You know, the resistor component has X amount of value. Somebody's pulling on that rope at a certain value. The only way there could be a sag in the rope would be if there was a sudden change so that there's not a match. So maybe I would think that a sag in the rope could certainly change the amount of deflection on the polar coordinate globe, which would, of course, then change the answer. So if you're anything that changes the angle on the polar coordinate globe, of course, does change the calculation. Okay, so Chief always brings me up with the text box comments. Gordon, how did I do about taking that was a very good question, Gordon. How did I do about taking it further to help illustrate the point? KY6V, NO70, over.
Well, you got me smiling and laughing at the same time. Very good, George. Well, I won't belabor this anymore. You could have answered that very succinctly by simply saying, if Murphy's there, their hands could slip. Go ahead and turn it over to Roger, KY6V.
You know, Gordon, I think that is a much better answer. If Murphy's Law applies, it certainly can and will. So, all right. Speaking of quantum flashes, here is super quantum coffee drinker, W4RFJ, NO70. Over to you.
Okay, very good. This is W4RFJ, and my next question is, Echo 5 Delta 01, what is the result of skin effect? Well, it depends on how much sun you get, but we're...
Chief, I think we've lost you. Chief, are you there? Over.
Thank you. Am I back?
Yes, sir.
I'm back, Roger. You're back. Over.
Basically, we're looking at skin effect, the effect of skin effect with alternating current. The higher the frequency, the more the current moves to the outer or thinner layer of the conductor closer to the surface. On page 57 of the study guide, there's an excellent graphical representation. DC shows current flowing all the way through it. Low frequency AC shows it starting to move toward the outer surface, and RF shows mostly toward the surface. Anybody have any questions on question or comments on question Echo 5 Delta 01? Hearing none. Over to you, George. W4RFJ in a quantum flash.
W4RFJ in the net, NO70. Thank you, Chief. All right. Up next is question Echo 5 D03, Echo 5 Delta 03. And the question is, what is microstrip? The answer for this is D. It is a precision printed circuit conductors above a ground plane that provide constant impedance interconnects at microwave frequencies. Now, microstrips are used to avoid changes in impedance from false grounds that result when the semiconductors are connected directly to a common ground with leakage into other circuit paths. Let me try to explain that a little bit more. If we're accustomed to thinking of non-integrated circuit or non-transistorized circuits, then we may be thinking way back to earlier construction. We were always taught to make sure everything is firmly grounded to earth ground. The problem with earth ground when dealing with integrated or transistorized circuits is that because of the behavior of the integrated circuit or transistor components, then there is some leakage between other parts of the circuit, which affects the earth ground itself, and therefore it's not really a true ground. You have to really artificially create a true ground that will avoid the impedance interconnects at microwave frequencies. You're constructing a more stable operating substrate or printed circuit board or prototype board, if you want to put it that way, in regard to creating this common ground that is preventing the false earth ground. So the answer again is the microstrip is a precision printed circuit conductor above a ground plane where that provides a constant impedance interconnect at microwave frequencies. That provides the constant impedance interconnects. The false grounds occur when you do not have that common ground. So are there any questions on the answer to D for Echo 5 D03? Over. Okay, nothing heard. Chief, over to you, W4RFJ, NO70. Over.
Okay, thank you, George. I appreciate that. And I guess this one here is, I don't know, it can be confusing, but the way I remember it, and it's another formula, but let me say it's Echo 5 Delta 10. That's E5 D10. How can the true power be determined in an alternating current circuit where the voltage and current are out of phase? Okay, well, here's the thing. Actually, there's a formula that you can use. First of all, the answer is by multiplying the apparent power times the power factor. Now, everybody's probably wondering, what the heck is a power factor? Well, the power factor is actually the cosine of the angle between voltage and current. My phone just dropped out on me. I guess I must be capacitively doing something here. So basically, the power factor is the cosine of that angle. Okay, so if you have an angle and you want to find the power factor, type the angle into your calculator, hit cosine, and that'll give you your power factor. As a matter of fact, we'll talk about that here before too long. And what they really don't get into is, how do you find true power? I mean, it's saying multiply the apparent power times the power factor, but how do you know what the apparent power is? You got to know what the true power is first, and then you get the angle, which gives you your power factor, and your power factor, if you turn that into, okay, I'm sorry, I'm carrying on. So I guess the whole point of the matter is there's a bunch of formulas that you need to know to find these values, but when it comes right down to it, true power, apparent power, and power factor have a relationship, and it's basically the same relationship that Ohm's law has. E divided by I times R. Okay, so if your current goes up, your resistance stays the same, your voltage is going to go down. So same thing goes here. If true power divided by apparent power times power factor, the power factor will never be greater than 1. It'll either be 1 or a decimal number. And your apparent power will never be lower than your true power, because if you have a power factor of 1, let me reset here. If you have a power factor of 1, meaning there's no angle, true power divided by apparent power, well, actually, better than that, you can actually find your cosine by taking your resistance and dividing it by your impedance, and that'll give you your cosine. And if it turns out to be 1, then your apparent power is 1, or is equal to true power. Okay, I digress. Sorry about that. Are there any questions about this? Have I been totally muddy on this one? Okay, I apologize if I carried on there a little bit, but basically the answer to that is, if you have the current's out of phase, your true power can be determined if you have the apparent power and the power factor by multiplying them together. Okay, George, back over to you, W4RFJ.
W4RFJ in the net, N070, and again, we're glad that you are with us for the extra class course this evening. And we're looking at the next question of Echo 5 Delta 12, E5D12. And Chief has just walked us through power factor. What we learned is that it's possible that the power factor or power available is going to be affected by the impedances and operating circuit characteristics. So it's reasonable to think, as Chief said, it's either going to be, you know, a 100% efficient circuit, or there's going to be some power that's not available. If there is a power factor of 0.2, let's look at the question. How many watts are consumed in a circuit having a power factor of 0.2 if the input is 100 volts AC at 4 amperes? All right, so we have a power factor of 0.2. This means that only a part of the power is available to us, as Chief just walked us through. So we have a power factor of 0.2. We have a voltage applied of 100 volts AC, and we have a current of 4 amperes. Now, you may recall from formulas that power is equal to voltage times current. P is equal to E times I. So That means that 100 volts times 4 amperes is 400 watts. And then if we apply the power factor of 0.2 to the 100 watts, that means that the available power, with the power factor, the watts consumed are 80 watts. Now, it looks like Chief has a way of explaining this a little bit better, and I'm grateful he's there. So, Chief, over to you to help work this out. W4RFJ, NO70. Over.
Okay. I guess what you're saying is correct, but I just read something here in your comment. You made a comment that apparent power is 100 volts times 4 amps, which is 400 watts. That doesn't make sense to me. That sounds to me like true power. The apparent power is going to be where you take the power factor of 0.2, which means it's 20% effective, or 20% power, 20% efficient. So the 100 volts times 4 amps is true power. Apparent power comes in when you take your power factor and divide it into your true power, which will, I haven't done the math on that, but the question here deals with how many watts are consumed, and that formula is correct. So I apologize if I messed that up.
W4FJNO70. What I'm hearing you say then, Chief, of course, is that by looking at the power factor of 0.2, what you're saying is that the power factor of 0.2 is used to measure the watts consumed compared to the voltage and current input, which then gets back into the waveforms and the calculations using the cosine or the phase angle and so forth. So did I hear correct in that what you're saying then is that the 0.2 is a way of estimating the power? And I see Gordon has a comment, KY6V, NO70. Over.
Yeah, I thought I'd try and throw my oar in the water here for a moment. What I read coming out of Roger is that he was taking issue, and I think correctly, in your statement that specifically read apparent power is 100 volts times 4 amps or 400 watts. The apparent should be changed to true. The true power is 100 volts times 4 amps or 400 watts, and the apparent power then would be the calculation that you gave. Am I reading you correctly, Roger? Over.
Actually, yes and no. Yes, you're reading me correctly on the true power issue. I did the math. At 0.2 power factor goes into 400 watts, the apparent power is 2,000 watts. But the question is, how many watts are consumed? And the answer is 80. That's something totally different. When you're talking about true power and apparent power, it's, let me see, P, it's a 4 amps times, I got to look at this again because something's not ringing right. How many watts are consumed in a circuit? I don't think that's the right answer. I think it's 2,000 watts because that is your apparent power. Am I right in that, Gordon?
No, I don't think so. I'm reading it as the actual power. I'm going to get away from apparent and true here. The actual power that is being delivered is 400 watts times 0.2, or 80 watts. what you're really utilizing. You're paying. You're probably paying for the true, but you're only getting the actual power, the apparent power. Do you agree with that, Raj? And then pass it back to George.
Yes. Yes. I thank you very much. Yeah, you're right. That apparent power just threw me right off. So you take 100 volts times 4 amps gives you 400 watts true power times the power factor. That's how much power is actually doing work for you.
I think we're there. Go ahead, George. Thank you, KY6V.
KY6V and WRJ NO70. Okay, well, I really am on board with what you guys are saying. I do need to identify concern with the study material that's posted on the website. If you look at Tilly's material on the newly released study guide under Echo 5 Delta 12, and rightfully or wrongfully, he has specified in his answers below that that the apparent power is 100 volts times 4 amperes or 400 watts, not true power. So as our class is studying for this, we should be aware of the calculations that have been set out, and also keep that in mind when looking at the reference material under Antilles' document for Echo 5 Delta 12. How did I do? KY6V NO70. Over.
Yeah, okay. Well, I think it's semantics. You know, you're starting out with something that calculates power as the voltage times the current, so that's 400 watts. But what you're really getting is 80 watts lost. It's flying out the window type thing. Okay, enough on this. Unless there's any questions from the audience. Roger, and it looks like you're up to E5 Delta 15. Oh.
Okay. Now that we got through that, very good. Well, this is going right along the same lines. Echo 5 Delta 15. What is the power factor of an RL circuit, that's resistor inductive circuit, having a 45 degree phase angle between the voltage and the current? Okay, so again, to find the power factor, we need to take and find the cosine of 45 degrees, which I looked it up on my handy-dandy calculator is 0.707. So the power factor being 0.707, which makes the circuit efficiency 70.7%. Now, here's a neat thought. If you had a circuit with 200 watts of true power and a 45 degree phase angle, what would the apparent power be? Well, I just so happen to know that it would be right around 282.86 watts. So, what you're ending up really paying for is 282.86 watts, even though you're only really doing 200 watts of power. Actually, you're not even using 200 watts. You're using 70% of that. So, anyway, anybody have any questions on how to find the power factor with the cosine of an angle? Over. Okay, another neat thought, too, if anybody's even interested, is that you can find that that power factor or the cosine of that angle by taking the resistance, if there's any pure resistance in that circuit, and dividing it by the impedance or Z, and that will give you the power factor. Okay, George, back over to you.
George, can I catch Tom for a moment, 6VK?
Absolutely. I heard a very little audio, but over to you, KY6V and NO70.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. Thanks for coming by when you could. You need to put your headset on. Your audio is very low. Just confirmation, are you okay for Saturday? You got the helm at 8 o'clock, over.
I am fine for Saturday as far as I know, unless I have another catastrophe. I fell again. Go ahead.
You're a gentleman and a scholar, a judge of fine women and whiskey, and a nice guy to boot. Thank you, Tom. I think it goes to you, George, KY6V.
Mike with a comment, CDQ. If you look in the text box, I put the formula in there that comes out of the ARRL test book, coming out of their license manual. It's in there in the text box. Over. Okay, go ahead.
KD0CDQ, NO7O. Well, thank you for that, Mike, and that, which is what I heard Chief and Gordon saying. So just as you look at the reference material, please be aware of the points that were made regarding the that question of ECHO5D12, if you want to take a look. All right, so we're going to move on now to sub-element ECHO6 circuit components. And the question that we're coming up to is ECHO6A07. ECHO6A07. Over. All right, so the question is, which of the following indicates that a silicon NPN junction transistor is biased? And the answer is D, a base-to-emitter voltage of approximately 0.6 to 0.7 volts. The voltage is measured across the base-to-emitter. Now, I'll admit that the wording of the question, I think, leaves something to be desired. So just to keep it simple, the operating characteristics of these transistors runs within a certain range. And, of course, when you're dealing with an NPN, then you can measure, when you measure the base to emitter voltage, it's going to show a resistance of approximately a base emitter voltage of approximately 0.6 to 0.7 volts. So the fact that it's measuring voltage, volts is a measurement of voltage, correct? So A and B are eliminated, and it's going to be either the C or D, a base to emitter voltage of 6 to 7 volts or of 0.6 to 0.7 volts. Well, the operating range is going to put it into the base to emitter voltage of approximately 0.6 to 0.7 volts, giving that as the answer to question ECHO6α07. Are there any questions, please? Call NO70. Over. Okay, nothing heard. So, Chief, it's over to you, W4FJ, NO70. Over.
Okay, George, I was also thinking, if I don't know if they have a question in there about germanium, but germanium transistors actually have a biasing voltage of about 0.3 volts, whereas the 0.6 to 0.7 is for silicon. Anyway, okay, so some trivia there. My last question for the evening is ECHO6α12. Why do many MOSFET devices have internally connected Zener diodes on the gates? And the answer is to reduce the chance of the gate insulation being punctured by static discharges or excessive voltages. And they talk about excessive voltages because a MOSFET, which is a metal oxide silicone field effect transistor, is very susceptible to static voltages. And as everybody knows, static voltages can build quickly and greatly. So those diodes basically provide a path for that static electricity to go before it pops a hole in the insulation between the gate and the rest of the FET. Okay, so does anybody have any questions or comments on question ECHO6α12? Hearing none, George, I pass it to you, sir. You have the baton.
Thank you, Chief. All right, we're going to move on now to question E6A16. What are the majority charged carriers in N-type semiconductor material? The majority charged carriers in N-type semiconductor material. And the answer is going to be free electrons, B. The N stands for negative. Electrons have a negative charge, and N-type semiconductors are made with a material that contains excess free electrons. So with the excess free electrons, then it makes it possible for the electrons to flow through because there are extra ones of them, which makes it conductive. The flow of electrons is defined, of course, as a flow of electricity, and therefore current flows through because of the excess number of electron charge characters. So that is the answer, free electrons, to ECHO-6A16. All right, and Chief, I'd like to go ahead and do the last set of ECHO-6A17 for you and ECHO-6B10 for me after I ask for any questions on ECHO-6A16. Any questions on E6A16, please call NO70. Over. Okay, nothing heard. So, Chief, if you could take, I believe you have set down on your email earlier, ECHO-6A17, and if you could turn it back to me after that, and I will do my final question then as well. So over to you, Chief, W4RFJ, NO70. Over.
Yeah, okay, George. The question I'm doing is ECHO-6A17. What are the names of the three terminals of a field effect transistor? And the answer is gate, drain, and source. If you look at it like a transistor, your gate, that's where the switch is, or the gate that allows the current to flow. The drain is where it's going to, and the source is where it's coming from. So the gate, drain, and source. Now, don't let this question fool you, because there are MOSFETs with gate 1 and gate 2, or dual-gated MOSFETs. But that's not the answer they're looking for. The three terminals of a field effect transistor is gate, drain, and source. So are there any questions, any comments on my last question? Okay, hearing none. George, yeah, I'm going to let you tie the ribbon on questions. I guess you pass it to Mike when you're done. And thanks for being there, sir. W4RFJ.
W4FJ in the net, NO70. Thank you, Chief. All right, I need to call the class's attention to the illustration in the FCC question pool document posted on the website for question ECHO-6B10, E6B10. It is figure E6-3. They have a question they want to ask you about that illustration in the question pool document, figure E6-3. There are 8 schematic symbols in that illustration under ECHO-6B10. The question is, in that figure E6-3, what is the schematic symbol for a light-emitting diode, or an LED? You may be familiar with LED when you go shopping at the hardware store. All right. Let me reset the link to give you the answer. The answer is in figure E6-3, the schematic symbol numbered 5 is the correct answer for a light-emitting diode. And there's a real easy way to keep your eyes from getting crossed at exam time when trying to figure out which of these is it, and it's a real easy way to remember. Please note in figure E6-3 that figure 5 is the only figure with 2 arrows pointing outward away from the junction in the transistor, and those arrows are not directly connected to the substrate. So as a memory tool to help you in the heat of the exam be able to see this, as a memory tool, those two arrows may be viewed as two rays leading away from the substrate, and because they are not directly connected to the substrate, it's not so much electromagnetic energy, but it is emerging energy that would be light energy, that you could consider to be light energy. Those two rays represent light energy leaving the transistor, so it is a light-emitting diode. The two arrows are the giveaway to it. So I hope that makes it real easy at the heat of the exam when the eyes are getting crossed. If they want to know about a light-emitting diode, it's two rays pointing away but not connected directly to the substrate itself. Are there any questions on E6B10? Please call N070. Over. Well, I don't hear any. So, Mike, we'll let you pick it up and tie the ribbons on it too as well. KD0CDQ, N070. Over to you, sir.
This is KD0CDQ. Yes, George, on that one, I always remember those little arrows as the emitting light. It's a very easy one to remember. It would be very gracious if you got that on the test. It's simple. I think we covered so much material tonight. I've been using a legal pad, and I got this legal pad full of all kind of stuff shorthand here so I could remember it a lot easier, getting rid of all the verbiage and just putting down the information. I think Roger and George did an excellent job this past Sunday and again tonight. This is some tough information that they covered, and they covered it in as simple a way as they possibly could. I have to give them kudos for that, okay? Very good job. I'd clap, but I don't want to make all that noise on the circuit. Anybody else have any comment about our two fine instructors we had tonight? Anybody want to make a comment? Go ahead, please. Well, I didn't hear any comments, but I'm sure they were making them mentally. Very good. Thank you, gentlemen. That is some tough material that you had to cover. It's not going to get much easier, but maybe it does. It gets easier because next week I'm doing it. And the classes, the questions I'm covering, I don't believe are as difficult as the ones that Roger and George have done this Sunday and Tuesday. Next Sunday, I'm going to put in the text box, these are the questions we'll be covering. We'll be covering from Echo 6 Charlie 01 to Echo 6 Foxtrot 14. Now, next week, I would suggest you have your diagrams out and have them available. We're going to use two of the figures on the question pool for, Sunday and Tuesday. So I would get kind of familiar with the figures. They're not that difficult, but you got to spend a little bit of time looking at these figures to figure, what am I looking at? So I would suggest that you download those figures, those pages, and keep them handy. I would keep them in a book anyway. I would keep a file and keep all of this material available. Like this little legal pad I just copied tonight, I've got all of this inductive and polar and impedance all over the place, skin effect. I've got all kind of notes there. It looks kind of scratchy, but this is what we need to do to pass these tests. Go over and over these questions until you understand what they mean, and then you can understand the answer. Letting it drop. KD0CDQ, do any extra classes for the ARRL test the FCC has graciously allowed us to take. These questions are very foreign to most of us. Unless you're in the electronic world and that's what you've done through your education and through your work career. If not, the best thing to do is to study each question or each group of questions that are saying the same thing, the same kind of a subject, and trying to understand. Help your brain to understand what am I looking at so that it's not as foreign. It takes a while. I don't believe this is the kind of a test you can just sit down and cram for. I think it's the kind of a test that takes time, unless you've got a real fast brain for recording things. I think I got a 1 gig brain, so it's kind of slow taking things in. But once they're in there, they kind of stick. So it took me, for the extra exam, I put aside 5 months. I looked at a calendar. I looked at a date, and I said, on that date, I'm going to go down and take the test, ready or not. And that's exactly what I did, ready or not. Went down in 5 months, took the test, bang, got it. No problem. But we have to challenge ourselves. We have to challenge ourselves to use our brain, memorize, understand what we're memorizing, understand what it's all about, and then setting a date and just do it. So it costs you, what, $15 to take a test? So maybe you don't pass, but maybe you do. And that's the thing. I believe you will. I think the odds are with us. If we honestly study and honestly put it into our brain, I think we can crack these tests. KD0CDQ, letting it drop. Anybody else have any comments about these exams? We're going to cut this off. We're 2 minutes after the hour. We're going to cut this off in a moment. Any other comments before we cut the recordings? Over. Okay, some more quiet comments. Okay, so next Sunday, same time, same station, it'll be myself, Mike, Kilo Delta Zero, Charlie Delta Quebec, and Richard. Richard is also NC5IR. He's down in Texas, and I'm in Kansas, so we're not too far away. We're a day's drive. we're good, I would say, 8 hour drive distance apart. Distances don't matter much out here in the West. You just drive until you get there. So, keep in mind that these classes are recorded. You can go over them at your leisure anytime. You don't have to be here at the exact times we're here. They're going to be up there, and we're going to, in a minute, we're going to all go quiet so that Gordon can turn off his recordings. So I'm going to ask that you please be quiet until Gordon comes aboard and tells us the recordings are turned off. KD0CDQ.
Thank you, Mike. All stations stand by, please. KY6V.
This has been the South Cars Outreach Program. Join us again next time for another in our series of training sessions for amateur radio operators. Goodbye for now.